We are now in a position where we're saying to people, it is not safe to move, it is not safe to leave these areas.
It's too smoky, can't do anything, it's not fun anymore, it's just scary, waiting. So yeah, pretty keen to get out.
Suddenly embers were coming over, but hundreds of embers just fast, just flying through the air. The wind was howling. The fire just created its own wind. It was just horrific, unbelievable.
I just can't even imagine trying to rebuild this town with all of these houses lost. It's going to be really hard.
We chose what we could save, houses that were defendable, and we just had to treat it as triage. Pick your battles and go in.
How come we only had four trucks to defend our town? Because our town doesn't have a lot of money, but we have hearts of gold, Mr. Prime Minister.
Every now and then I just feel nauseous at the thought of what's happened and at the recovery effort that's got to happen here.
The fires are not over. The crisis is not over. There are months to go, and particularly in the southern states.
I actually have held it together pretty well till yesterday when I heard that it could be coming back. And that's when I had my breakdown.
In Australia, wildfires continue to devastate the southern part of the country. So far, at least 20 people have died and roughly 2,000 homes have been destroyed. And ecologists say nearly 500 million animals have been killed since the fires started in September. As global warming causes temperatures to rise, hotter and drier conditions are playing a significant role in the growing intensity of wildfires across the world. One solution, supported by indigenous communities in both Australia and here in the United States, involves setting fires intentionally.
At the core of those tribal or indigenous philosophies, fire is medicine, and when you prescribe it in the correct way, it can enhance and maintain ecosystem service production.
That is
Frank Lake, a Forest Service research ecologist with the Pacific Southwest Research Station Fire and Fuels Program. I'm also a Karuk descendant, having grown up with my Yurok and Karuk family in northwestern California.
Frank works at the United States Forest Service, and one of his main priorities is to incorporate tribal knowledge into the federal government's fire management strategies.
Society and many land managers or fire managers are struggling with how to learn to live with wildfire. And most of the assumptions are that these are natural areas, or that there was a wilderness, or that there was very little effect of Aboriginal or Indigenous people, particularly their fire use and stewardship in these systems, yet there's these long-term, deep relationships of Aboriginal or Indigenous people with fire that affected the fire regimes and affected fire effects across the landscape, across many different ecosystems and habitats.
Today, scientists in the United States Forest Service largely agree with tribal members that intentionally burning sections of forests is an important way to protect against wildfires. But many tribal experts say we need to dramatically step up our use of prescribed fires going forward. Joining me now is Chukchuk Hillman, a Kuruk Indian who works with the Kuruk Tribe's Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for coming on the show, Chukchuk.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. And I'm excited to talk to you about this because our guest at the top said that fire is medicine. And if you can explain how it works, I mean, what does a prescribed fire look like exactly?
Well, nowadays it looks quite a bit different from historical use, just because the landscape has been lacking fire, you know, since contact. And really, you know, we're a late contact community here. Contact didn't happen until about 1851, and the miners really didn't like fire, and then landscape kind of built up with, lots of material, flammable material that it's in a bad way now. So now we have to have lots of resources available to do prescribed fire, where traditionally you could have just a couple family members burn off large sections of landscape. And so it's not like, you don't do it to just be prepared for wildfire. You're working with fire for health on the landscape in these fire-dependent plant communities and human communities.
So how is it that, I mean, because it sounds counterintuitive to say that burning parts of the forest is the best way to fight wildfires. How does it work exactly?
So for one, you've got a chunk of black, you know, but what we're looking for, we're not looking for just gray, completely charred ground. You're looking for some black that still has some carbon in it, you know, so you're looking for a low to moderate intensity fire. And so then once some wildfire comes through, it's not going to burn that area so hot because you don't have the fuel load up. So even if it's at a bad time of year, if it's not, the fire's not getting up into the crowns of the trees, you can have a low to moderate intensity understory fire. Like I said, right now there's so many fir trees because they call plantations over here that are, you know, like cornfields but for dug fir for timber production, and so those places are really unnatural landscape features that are now really dangerous when you have fire. But traditionally, we had a much more open landscape in the lower elevation areas where humans are living, and you're using fire all the time, but in different intervals for different plant species, sometimes in the spring, sometimes in the fall, sometimes even in the summer when the conditions are appropriate for those plant communities. You already have ridges as natural holding features that are more open and can just take fire in a healthy way, and that's what we're trying to do, is set the landscape on a trajectory to accept fire in a good way. Because you can burn off pretty good chunks of land, just a couple people, if the landscape is ready to take it and you don't have a huge fuel loading, the landscape can take it in a healthy way.
Has the federal government worked with your tribe to carry out these burns, and if so, what does that look like?
Well, that's just now starting. It's taken a really long time, and that's something that we have in common with Aboriginal folks in Australia, too. We had a person from the government and an Aborigine man come up here and visit me last year, and they saw the writing on the wall, and they were attempting to move in the same direction, working as partners to get fire on the land. So we have the federal government working with us. There's still a lot of work to be done, but we're hoping that we can be in time to save some of these forested areas and valued resources in these communities.
Chuchuk, you mentioned that you had a visit from an Aboriginal tribe member in Australia. Tell me what they were looking for, given that they are going through their own natural disaster right now.
Well, that's what he was coming up to meet with me about, is how to avert a natural disaster like this, you know. And part of it, I would say it's an unnatural disaster because of, you know, this criminalizing indigenous fire. You've taken out humans from the ecosystem, which, you know, I would posit humans are a naturally occurring element in nature. And so if you take humans out of the equation and our use of fire, then you have an unnatural situation where then when some lightning strikes or something, you have this, you know, incredible disaster. But that's what is missing from our oral history. If we have all these stories going back thousands and thousands of years, and what's not in those stories is catastrophic wildfire. But it's because of our relationship with fire. And that's what humans have to reconcile, is a relationship with fire. And I'd like to make the point that just the way that it's talked about here in the U.S. and other places, when a human has, you know, some relationship to fire, they're called a pyromaniac. Like, we talk about it like it's a mental health issue, when really it's not. It's our responsibility to the world is to use fire to keep the world healthy.
There's been an interesting history, particularly when it comes to prescribed fires here in the United States. We know that since the 1960s, the National Park Service has allowed for some of these prescribed fires to take place. But prior to that, there was a history of criminalizing fire, these prescribed fires. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that, particularly how white settlers responded to tribal fire practices in the 1800s and 1900s.
Yeah, well, you colonize and then you criminalize, and you know, this is our birthright, you know, and it's a responsibility. We say that when you're born with hands and thumbs, you have this responsibility to the world, and fire is one of those things that we have some power to work with, and you take it out, and it's going to be an issue. And the Weeks Act was passed in 1911. And so that was when fire suppression really got kicking pretty strong over in our area here. But yeah, it's you could be hung, shot, imprisoned for doing that. And I mean, we have documentation from a forest ranger here in our area saying the only way to stop Indians from burning is to take a shot. He said they're like coyotes in the bushes, always lighting fires. But we weren't lighting fires for no reason.
I'm wondering also if you could tell, we got about a minute left in the segment, you could tell us what policies you want to see the U.S. government put in place for prescribed fires.
Well, just working with local indigenous communities wherever you are, go to the local indigenous people because they've been doing this for a really, really long time. You got to work with your local community, and I'm not sure what that looks like in each community.
Chukchuk Hillman is a Kuruk Indian who works with the Kuruk Tribes Department of Natural Resources. Chukchuk, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.